All right, it's the Nachum Segal Network, and this segment is, of course, called Buy the Book. I want to thank our friends at Koren Publishers who continue to sponsor this amazing hour each and every week. Remember that all Koren and Magid books are available at Jewish bookstores everywhere, including J. Levine on West 30th Street between Broadway and Fifth Avenues in New York City. And the commuter special continues to thrive. If you want to bring the Beit HaMikdash to life by studying Maseches Yoma in color, order a subscription to the print edition of the Koren Talmud Bavli. Get a free digital edition. The digital edition is compatible on all mobile devices, including your iPod, tablet, iPad, and more. The package is $60 for each volume, has a value, I should say, of $60 for each volume. It is perfect for your commute to work. You can go to korenpub.com and use the promo code JM in the AM at checkout. Again, that's korenpub.com, promo code JM in the AM. It is a great honor to have Rabbi Beryl Wine with us this week. Rabbi Wine is responsible for two brand new works, one entitled The Oral Law of Sinai, an Illustrated History of the Mishnah, and one entitled Vision and Valor, an Illustrated History of the Talmud. In The Oral Law of Sinai, it's an extraordinarily beautifully illustrated book that explores the Mishnah, as Rabbi Wine explains. The Talmud is two separate books comprising the Oral Law. This work offers an explanation of the first book of the Talmud, the Mishnah. Rabbi Wine guides the reader through the mysteries of the Mishnah that detail ethical principles and moral values. It's also filled with legends and stories of psychological and historical observations. The Mishnah discusses medicine, pharmacology, dreams, botany, astronomy, and mathematics, as well as human and animal biology. There's nothing about human existence, nothing about life, humans, nature, spirituality, or physicality that is a taboo subject. All is Torah, all is holiness. The Oral Law of Sinai is replete with humor, irony, pathos, soaring optimism, and cold-hearted realism. Its drama emerges from the give and take of intensive scholarly debate and unending questioning, problem solving, and hypotheses. In Vision and Valor, Rabbi Wine traces the development of the Talmud. The record of the Oral Law at Sinai is refined, debated, and discussed over four centuries in the great Torah academies of the land of Israel and Babylonia. This beautifully illustrated, footnoted, oversized volume is a necessity for every Jewish home interested in the soul of Judaism, its rituals, values, and practices. Rabbi Beryl Wine, an honor to welcome you to the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Rabbi Wine, how is it that our oral law specifically, but really so much of the development of scholarship through the years in Jewish tradition, did in fact turn into a work, a book, a volume, plus many other volumes of dealing with every topic of humanity? How did it become that what would essentially be a basis for our tradition or a book of laws and guidebooks for our heritage, in fact, did become something that covered every single topic of human existence?
Well, the Torah itself is all-encompassing. The Torah describes itself as Zeh Sefer Toldos Adon, this is the book of humankind. So the Torah itself is all-encompassing. And the written Torah, which our teacher Moses wrote and was revealed to the Jewish people in Sinai and at the desert, there was an oral law that was given at the same time, because otherwise the written law doesn't make any sense. So the oral law is what explains it, expounds it, etc. And throughout the centuries, from the time of when the Jewish people entered the land of Israel till about the year of 200 of the Common Era, that oral law was, as the name implies, it was oral.
Right.
But conditions of Roman conquest, the impending long exile, the difficulty of committing all of this to memory and to oral law. So over the centuries, people made notes. They never published them, but they made notes for themselves. And so we had something called the Mishnah Rishona, which already is from the time of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, from the men of the Great Assembly, the beginning of Second Temple times. And then it developed, and then Rabbi Akiva had his notes, so to speak, and then Rabbi Meir had his notes. And in the end of the second century, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yudah HaNasi, took it upon himself to order all of these notes, put them into order, and to write, edit, and produce the Mishnah and publish it.
And I want to talk about those personalities and others in a minute, but I'm so curious, and obviously you were not around in that era, I was not around in that era, do you think it's obvious, or not necessarily so, that the oral law, as we know it today, because it's written, has itself a different type of personality than when it was only the oral law? Is it possible that it's just
Well, any time you take something that's oral and you put it down in writing, you constrict it. And so that's why the Talmud had to come along. And that's why the commentators to the Talmud until our day, everybody adds a layer, so to speak, because the nature of the oral law is that it's never completed.
Right. The Mishnah to the outside observer looks more, more organized, more on point, more relevant in regard to sticking to the topic than the Talmud ever did.
Well, the Mishnah is concise. The order is exact. The Rebbe was a great editor. But the Talmud is more free-flowing. The Talmud is basically, we could say, a tape recording, a CD of the discussions that took place in the great academies of learning from the beginning of the 3rd century till the 7th century, probably, the 6th or 7th century. And therefore, it's free-flowing. It doesn't necessarily always stick to the topic, but eventually it gets back to the topic. It's a combination of many, many things. You pointed out, it's a book of laws, but it's not just laws. It's a book of people.
So,
and it has anecdotes, and it has advice, and it has, and it also, the interesting thing is that it has so many different opinions. There's not one size fits all here.
Right.
Now the halakha has to come to a conclusion, but all the opinions are recorded and kept.
So then, is it frustrating or is it incorrect if in fact the Talmud has that type of personality, like we just described, to nitpick at the words of the Talmud? Is it much more inappropriate once you get to the Talmud to do that than, for instance, the Mishnah or anything that may have preceded it?
Well, the Mishnah is limited. I mean, it's concise, it's curt, it's cryptic. I mean, that's what he wanted to do with it.
Right. So if someone would go ahead and analyze why this word was or was not used in the Talmud, apply what we might do sometimes with the Chumash or Tanakh and apply it to Talmud, that would be a bad strategy, correct?
Well, I think that, first of all, the Talmud is in Aramaic.
Right.
And the Mishnah is in Hebrew.
Right.
Which is a great difference. Hebrew by nature is a concise language. Hebrew by nature has many more nuances to it. One word can mean 15 different things. Aramaic was the lingua franca. It's the language that people spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore it has a more homey character to it. And it's much more of a conversation than the mission is.
Something that we're getting used to as English continues to be more and more of a...
Yeah, well, the English, the Talmud in English is today very widespread, and Torah learning in English is very widespread. So English became the language, but the English also does not contain the nuances that Hebrew does.
Rabbi Beryl Wein is with us. Do you have any idea how many books you've been associated with over the years? Do you have any clue what the number is?
Well, you and I?
You.
Oh, again.
The question I'm asking is, do you have any idea at this point how many books, how many publications you've been associated with over the years?
I know publication. I've written 16 books.
Wow.
But I write a lot. I have a monthly newsletter that I've been putting out for.
Yeah, by the way, your recent article has made quite a splash, by the way. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that toward the end of this conversation. But your analysis of some of the things going on in this world of ours certainly.
We're a very interesting
team. You can say that again. Rabbi Wide, in these two words, one is called the Oral Law of Sinai, the other one is Vision and Valor, one on the Mishnah, one on the Talmud, brand new. So at some point, you had to decide which personalities of the Mishnaic era and the time around the Mishnaic era would be included in this book.
I'll tell you, the basic research for this book, as one can see in the notes at the back of the book, and I'm very proud of the notes, the basic sources for the book is it's the Mishnah of the Talmud itself.
Right.
I would say 85-90% of all the sources are the Mishnah and the Talmud.
But
I didn't look at outside sources.
No, understood. But if you're writing about, I don't know, 30 to 40 personalities, I'd have to assume some were left out, correct?
Well, a lot of them are left out because of the fact that maybe they're mentioned very infrequently.
Right.
And when you put out a book, there's an editor that edits, and there's a publisher that publishes, and there's a limit to how many pages they want to publish, you know? So all of that factors in, but I would say that these books are pretty inclusive, pretty much who should be included, I think, is included.
Why are they?
Truth is that the Talmud, even though it has hundreds of people who are listed, there may be 20 to 25 that are the Talmud.
Right. Understood. Why are the illustrations in both these books so vital to this reading experience?
Well, I first of all, illustrations are always vital because you got to satisfy the eye, not just the brain. But in this case, they are vital because of the fact that they show the culture, the environment in which it was written. Right. You know, none of this happened in a vacuum. It didn't descend en masse from Mars, you know, and here it is. It is written by people in conditions, in countries, under circumstances. So you have to show, the Talmud discusses the economy, you have to show what the economy was. Agriculture, you got to show what the agriculture was. It discusses trades, and you have to know what the trades look like, and you have to know the geography of where and what. And you have to realize that, for instance, that Rabbi Akiva and Rava never met. And we're talking about a span of many, many centuries. And even though in the Talmud the discussion is as though they're sitting across the table from each other talking to each other, but they're not really doing so. It's a discussion that spans centuries.
Right.
I think that's the greatness of Torah, that Torah can do that. That, I always have that feeling now that I thank God I'm already a great-grandfather. You know, a very older person can sit down with a five-year-old child and study Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And it bridges time, and it bridges place. And that really is the secret of the Talmud, is that it's not limited. And therefore, the Jews lived a Talmudic life throughout the exile. In other words, if the rabbis of Babylonia of the 7th century or 5th century came to Poland in the 19th century, they would recognize life.
Right.
But the task is to be able to interpret the Talmud in every generation as to what it is saying to that generation.
Were they right?
That really is a cardinal of cardinal importance.
The question is, would they recognize anything about life today? But that's a separate issue, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, the technology would be unbelievable.
Right.
Because many of the things that, the Rambam, for instance, and the Rambam is way after the Talmud, the Rambam, when he wants to give an example of an impossibility, says, "A Sfina shel Barzel, a ship that's made out of iron that flies in the air.
Right.
So he said that's impossible because in the 12th century it was impossible. But today we know that not only is it possible, that's the industry, right? We all fly.
You were just on one recently, one of those ships of metal flying in the air.
Yeah, so because of that, therefore, the technology would certainly astound anybody that comes from a different age. I'm astounded that my grandchildren can operate their little things much greater. I don't know what to do with them.
Rabbi Beryl Wine is with us, founder and director of the Destiny Foundation. Buy the book. Our friends from Koren Publishers bring you this amazing hour each and every week. All Koren and Magid books available to Jewish bookstores everywhere, including Jay Levine on West 30th Street in New York City. The commuter special, you could bring the Beit HaMikdash to life by studying Maseches Yoma in color. Order your subscription to the print edition of the Koren Talmud Bavli. Get a free digital edition. The digital is compatible on all mobile devices, including your iPod, tablet, iPad, and more. The package has a $60 value for each volume. Perfect for your commute to work. Go to korenpub.com. Korenpub.com. Use the promo code JM in the AM when you check out. Rabbi Beryl Wine, The Oral Law of Sinai, an illustrated history of the Mishnah, and Rabbi Beryl Wine, Vision and Valor, an Illustrated History of the Talmud, as we speak about these two brand-new works. I'm looking at the list of those who you included in the book on the Mishnah. Is there any Mishnaic personality to whom we could put the label controversial? Is there somebody that stood out in any way as more controversial than his colleagues throughout those centuries?
Well, I mean, you have Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, who was even placed in Cherem. It was even the rabbis excluded him because of various reasons. A lot of them are controversial. Great people always, there's no... What makes a person great is that he has ideas. He's, so to speak, out of the box a little. And that always engenders, my rule in life is there's always another rabbi.
Right.
No matter what. So you have Rabbi Meir, for instance, who is very controversial, and you had Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch. I mean, there are many people, and the Talmud tells their stories. It's not that I'm telling a story or I'm writing a history book. The Talmud tells their story. The only thing is that the stories are scattered. If you try and put them together and you got a picture of the person, that's a different matter. The Talmud tells us certain people were very tall and certain people were short and certain people were extremely heavy, obese, and certain people were frail. And the Talmud tells us all of this. But, in the yeshivas, for instance, we have, I remember when I was a student and later when I was a Rebbe, when you came to what was called Agadita, which are stories or biographies or et cetera, they would skip it.
Right.
Because, we were concentrating on halacha, and we were concentrating on developing learning skills, et cetera. So there was no impetus to know the stories. But the truth is that without the stories and without knowing something about the people that's involved, I really think that one's appreciation of the Talmud and one's overview of the Talmud is certainly impeded. There's a lot of things that you don't get because of the fact you don't know who's saying it, you don't know why he said it, you don't know where he was, you don't know what his circumstances were. And the Talmud tells us the famous story of Ram Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua, that Rabbi Yeshua was a blacksmith and poor and lived in a house that was covered with soot and with carbon. And Ram Gamliel was shocked when he visited him. And Ram Gamliel was the Nasi, was the prince. He lived in a palace. And Rabbi Yeshua is living in a hovel. And Rabbi Yeshua reprimands him. He says, "Ein ato yodea tzaron shel tamidei chachomim. You don't appreciate the life that the poorer class, so to speak, has to exist. And therefore, you're lacking in that lack of appreciation." Well, the Talmud itself tells us that story because it wants us to understand that when it says the rule that you cannot judge somebody else unless you are in his place, they meant it. and you have to therefore be able to put yourself in that person's place, which is never easy to do. But again, we see that throughout the Talmud, not just in the anecdotes, in the halacha as well.
I wonder when we live in such a disposable society today where everything, you know, can just be thrown out, replenished in some other way, shape, or form, how the same thing would apply, how all of us in many ways, or many of us, I should say, are in what would be considered by people in that era to be the lap of luxury, and we don't really consider. You know, we read, for instance, very recently, one of my children was studying about, if you have enough money only for Shabbos candles or Hanukkah candles. Very difficult questions to relate to these days.
Yeah, I will agree with that. I will agree that that we can't relate to the poverty of Eastern Europe,
right,
a century ago. I mean, just we can't relate to what happened in the Holocaust. We you know, you just can't. So again, you know, we have to realize that we can't relate.
So
if you realize that, then you're relating already somehow.
So let's for a moment focus on the many Mishnaic, but much more, I think, Talmudic statements like to be quoted by people in regard to, for instance, a big topic of living in Israel or not, right? And where it falls in the, in the scheme of things regarding our mitzvos, what type of mitzvah it is, whether it's important, not important, et cetera, et cetera. There are books written on this topic. You, of course, know that. Is it sometimes important to keep in mind that almost all the Talmudic statements, like you're pointing out, are, even if they're as objective as possible, are still within a certain context. And that we, no matter what, even if we want to quote them, learn from them, establish policy today based on them, we have to remember that many of them are out of context.
Well, much of the policy that exists in the Jewish religious world is almost the opposite of what's written in the Talmud. So you see that, people feel that times have changed, or circumstances have changed, or the necessities have changed, and that, so to speak, they don't bind us. I mean, the Talmud says everybody's got to have a job. Everybody has got to go to work. You have to teach your son how to make a living, et cetera, et cetera. That's not necessarily the prevailing built on Chong in our world today.
It sounds like that frustrates you.
So in saying that, I'm not making a comment, but in saying that, you have to realize that the later commentators in every generation have always interpreted the Talmud and have always, so to speak, adapted it's obvious, for instance, that Talmudic medicine should not be followed today.
Right.
All of the commentators say that, you know. They were telling you the best medicine that they knew at that time, you know. And we, mainly because of our technology, have a different view of it. Well, the same thing is true of astronomy, and the same thing is true of other sciences. The Talmud is not meant to be a work of physics,
but if we're
chemistry.
But if we're going to highlight the fact that medicine, pharmacology, botany, astronomy, etc., is included in the Mishnah and Talmud, one would think that the reason we're highlighting it is because it would apply, or at least would give us a tremendous number of lessons in those areas for today. Is it in fact?
I think what the Talmud really applies today is that they were the master psychologists. They knew people. People have not changed.
Mm.
Listen, the agriculture has changed. There's no question it's changed, right? And what we have in the problems in agriculture today, and that's dealt with the poskim that we have today, especially here in Israel, where all the laws are germane. So then it becomes a question, right? Crossbreeding, what's kelayim, what can you can use, etc. What is done today was unimaginable in the time of the Talmud. But that's not a problem. The Talmud, when it speaks about people, though, they're speaking about us.
And if there was a policy in our tradition, for instance, not to borrow. or to donate organs from one body to be used, you know, for a living being who needs it. Obviously, they...
Well, the time of the Talmud, it was impossible.
Right, it was impossible.
They didn't even discuss it.
And then
But the later commentators discussed it, and then there was a question of autopsies,
right.
And then you have the famous Tshuva, the Noda Biyehuda already in the 18th century. You know, that's the greatness of halacha, is that it develops to answer the questions of the time. The Talmud never spoke about electricity. What is electricity? That's one of the great problems in halacha that exists today. We really don't have a clear handle on what's the definition of electricity.
But when someone, for instance, like today, I'll give you an example. It seems like among Orthodox travelers, and again, not across the board, but among Orthodox travelers, it seems more and more people are relying on positions that magnetic keys that go in hotel room doors can now be used. So obviously there's some people on one side of the issue, and there are others who are ironclad on the other side.
Yeah, but that's really a question of, again, what is electricity?
Right.
So, you know, Shlomo Zalman had one definition. The Chazon Ish had another definition. The Aruch HaShulchan had a third definition. The Zeichemet brings different opinions. It's not clear what it is. So therefore, it's not clear how to deal with it. And that problem, for instance, this is based on Dover Sheinu Miskavin or Melocha Sheinu Tzuchi Legufa, which is discussed in the Talmud. So then the question is, does this fit into those parameters or not?
Right.
That's really what a posek has to do.
Understood.
He has to see what the circumstances he's deciding on, what parameters it fits into, what definition does he take.
Understood, but not to belabor the point, because it's a little bit off topic, but wouldn't you agree that if not for the necessity, I don't know, Velcro and toilets, frankly, and Pampers, there'd be plenty of people calling for them never to be used on Shabbos, but hasn't its necessity sometimes caused a need for it to seep onto the permitted side of Jewish law?
Well, then again, the Talmud itself says that we build a fence around it. We don't. Our tendency is to protect the Shabbos and not to make it look like Tuesday.
Right.
Now, it's very possible that there can come a technology that everything can be done on Shabbos, and it will not be a technical violation of halacha. But that's not a Shabbos.
The difference between...
So that's the psychological part that also is part of the Torah.
Right, because aside from Chilul Shabbos, we're concerned about Bittul Shabbos.
That's right. So that can, you know, all of that can happen, you know. Our world became a lot simpler, but a lot more complex.
Rabbi Beryl Wein is with us, a founder and director of the Destiny Foundation, widely recognized expert on Jewish history, which he has popularized through lectures, books, seminars, television, and radio, films. Founder of Yeshiva Shari Torah in Suffern, New York, he has been the recipient of numerous awards, and most recently the Torah Prize Award from the Machon Harav Frank in Yerushalayim for his teaching achievements. He is with us as we discuss two brand new works, which we are, of course, highly recommending. One is entitled The Oral Law of Sinai, An Illustrated History of the Mishnah, and one, Vision and Valor, An Illustrated History of the Talmud. I don't know if it's fair for me to say this, because I don't know if it's true across the board, but, Rabbi Wein, it seems all of your works, all of your written book publications have a special beauty to them. And I don't know if it's you or the publishers you've worked with, but, you know, there are people who just release books and make them available to the public. It seems the majority of yours, I don't know, are large coffee table, some of them very colorful, even the smaller ones, you know, have a beautiful look to it. I assume that's done on purpose.
Well, my good friend, Rabbi Zlotowicz, once told me that anybody who says that you can't tell a book by its cover is not in the book business. And that's true. I mean, as I said, a book has to be appealing to the eye, not just to the brain. And if the book is printed wrongly, if the type is too small, if it doesn't flow, if it doesn't attract you, if the cover doesn't say anything to you, so then, it lacks, and that, in my opinion, that's you've seen that revolution in Sifrei Kodesh also today. I mean, when I grew up, almost every sefer looked the same. You know, it had a blue cover and it had the name on it and goodbye. And then today, it's much more regal. The print is much better. It's appealing to you, right? So you want to read it, you want to study it, you want to. You're proud to have it on your shelf.
On the topic of how different things look today, let's spend a couple of minutes on the Talmud portion of these two books. Many people listening right now are very familiar with what the page of Talmud, the page of Gemara, looks like to us over the last couple of hundred years. How different from, I don't know, 800 years ago or 900 years ago or other eras?
Well, the way it looks now is really Bamberg, who was not a Jewish printer, who was a non-Jewish printer in Germany in the 16th century. He is the one that put Rashi on one side and the Tosas on the other side and the Gemara in the middle, which is the basis for all Talmudic printing since then. But the pagination has changed. You say Daf Lamed Aleph Omer Aleph, but 500 years ago, there wasn't Daf Lamed Aleph. And the standard pagination that we have today and the shape of the page, etc., is from the famous Vilna Shas, from the Ram printing press in Vilna. You know, there's a book that just came out. I don't mind pushing other books as well, by Rabbi Akiva Aronson. It's called The People of the Book. It's the history of Jewish printing from the 15th century till our time. It's fascinating. And if you have that book and you look at it, it's also beautifully illustrated, etc., you'll see how it developed. You'll see what a boon the printing press was for Torah study.
I'm looking at page 6 and 7 of your book, 12th and 13th century editions of the Talmud. Where was Rashi?
He was in a separate scroll.
Simple as that.
A separate book.
You needed to go to the Judaica shop and buy a Rashi.
That's right. And that's why it was called the Kuntres, right? Because it was a separate book. And there were many, many different editions of Tosfos. And it's basically the printers that decided which Tosfos are in and which are not. So, I mean, like today, for instance, you go to the bookstore and you buy a Tosfos or Rosh, right?
Uh-huh.
So those were the Tosfos in the Rosh based on the Maram in Rotenberg. Okay, but that's a separate book. It's not printed into the page of the Talmud. Who decided that he would put the Re in Masechet Shabbos, and he put Rabbeinu Peretz in Makos? Who decided that? The printer decided that.
And the only thing that comes to my mind as you say all this is inaccuracies. I mean, there must have been...
Oh, so then, there's an entire field of Jewish study called printer's errors. But printer's errors have become part of it, and then we are constantly striving to get to the right text, to the correct text. You saw all the Rishonim, the Tochi Garcinan, right? You know, this is what it should say. You're dealing with millions of words, an enormous amount that go through human hands, so that the mistakes have to occur. I give you an example. I mean, that's the example that I love. Is, you know, that on the high holidays we recite with great fervor Yimloch Hashem Lo'olam Alakayach Tzion Lador Vador Hallelujah, right?
Right.
And then we say Ve'ato Kodosh Yoshev Tilos Yisrael Eil No.
Right.
There is no such pasuk. The pasuk is Ve'ato Kodosh Yoshev Tilos Yisrael. Period. What happened? How did Eil No get in there? Because when they were putting together printed pages, they printed every page individually, so they had to know what was the next page. So at the bottom of the page, they put a word or two, which was the first word or two of the next page.
Right.
And the next piyut is Keil Noah, Lolam Turot, Lolam Tugdosh, etc. So they printed Keil Noah at the bottom. After a while, a printer took it from the bottom and he put it to the top. And it became, and he added it to Ata Kodosh Oshev Tilos Yisrael. So there it is. And everybody says it, including the great Rabbi Wein, but that's the way it is.
And Rabbi Wein does continue to say it because?
Because my father said it. My grandfather said it.
Tradition.
And we see that somehow it's worked, right? So maybe in heaven they adopted it too.
And the
but there are many, many printer's errors that exist. And therefore, you see, for instance, the Rambam, Frankel, Shapsi Frankel, put out the Rambam. He put an enormous amount of money and effort and everything to get to a correct text. And all the Shasim that are coming out now, also, there's a tremendous effort to get to a correct text, to compare different manuscripts, to take them from different places, whether they be... from England, you know, Henry VIII's Shas, or whether they be from the Vatican. I mean, today they're all accessible. That's the difference. So in our time, we can look at them. And, you know, many times, it's almost a detective story to put it together, but many times we find that that an error really had an influence.
Excuse me for taking advantage and changing the topic for a moment, but based on something you just alluded to, did you see the photo of the Prime Minister of Israel with a Chanukiah between him and the Pope?
I didn't see that, but I would imagine that he would give one, yeah.
And, I mean, the joke that was going around was yeah, it looks like this, just a little larger, you know, meaning, of course, a reference to what is likely still in the Vatican today. And when it comes,
well, we don't know. I mean, I don't know if they know.
Right, you know? It's just conjecture, of course, and has always been a much talked about topic. But in terms of publications, in terms of manuscripts, that we do definitively know, correct?
Well, that, after the Shoah, the Church relaxed on its control on Jewish manuscripts, and you could get microfilms, and they're much more cooperative today than they have ever been, because that basically, you know. The church is changing too, you know, much as we don't change our attitude towards it, but the church is changing and continues to change, and we have to hope for the best.
Oh, I don't know. I think previous generations, if they analyzed it, would say that, in fact, we are changing our attitude toward them. I think people would say that, but...
to a certain extent, it's kamayim ponim oponim. The church renounces anti-Semitism as it has. And the church has recognized the state of Israel as it has. And as the Pope has once said, you know, that the Jews are our elder brother.
Right.
Those are in the Middle Ages, nobody would ever say that.
That's for sure.
So therefore, the attitudes change, and we hope they have to change for the better, right? And they have to be open for to change it.
No question about it. Vision and Valor, an illustrated history of the Talmud. Okay, for those who are just picking up the... overview of the Talmud as a pursuit. There is we've always heard in our tradition that there is a difference, a dichotomy between those Amoraim, those Talmudic scholars who were in Babel and Babylonia, and those who were in Israel or Jerusalem. We'll put it that way. Is there a way to sum up how one would view the two groups?
Well, first of all, the dialect is different. So the Aramaic dialect is different. Secondly, the Yerushalmi was aborted. It stopped in about 320. The Bavli kept on going for a couple of hundred years. And therefore, because of that, the Rif says that that's the reason we always decide the halacha according to the Bavli and not according to the Yerushalmi. And the Yerushalmi became sort of a resource book. But the difference was the conditions of life in the land of Israel. There were two main yeshivas in the land of Israel, one in Tveria and one in Caesarea. And, you know, in Tveria is Rabbi Yochanan or Rish Lakish, basically, and in Caesarea was Rabbi Abua. And they developed and studied the Mishnah, and they came to their conclusions. Many of their conclusions would be different than the conclusions that were arrived at by the scholars in Bavel. But the Rif points out very accurately that the scholars in Bavel all were aware of the opinions of the Yerushalmi, and they factored them in. And if they disagreed, so that means they had good reason to disagree. And it's also very important to know that the Yerushalmi, we see Tosfos uses it often as a resource, but it's a window into the situation, the land of Israel, and the Yerushalmi had to operate under the Romans, and then it had to operate under the Byzantine Christians, and when the Jewish community in the land of Israel was practically destroyed, so the Yerushalmi couldn't maintain itself anymore.
What led to the completion of the Talmud in Babylonia in the early 400s?
I don't think they ever meant to have a conclusion. You know, the Gemara says that Ravina and Rav Ashi were the end, but then there were Rabbonim Savaroi. That part of the writings of the Rabbonim Savaroi also filtered into the Talmud. It's hard to have a clear definition, but what ended was the fact that they felt that everything that had to be written was written, everything that had to be said was said, and then what really changed it was that the Gaonim concentrated in interpreting the Talmud more than in adding to the Talmud.
Mm. So if there was some Talmudic-like scholarship still going on after that time, during some of the...
I said some of it filtered through. I mean, there's vast opinion that the first page and a half of Kedushin is from a much later period.
Right, understood.
Savaroi, and it just it was incorporated. So there are other things.
Right.
And then there's a whole, I don't want to get into it because I don't know anything about it, but that never stops me. But the there's a whole genre of Talmudic scholarship, scientific Talmudic scholarship, that's taught in, especially here in Israel, in the universities, which examines the text from a completely different viewpoint and tries to somehow piece it together. So some of the works are very valuable, and some of it are almost nonsensical. So it depends how you look at it.
So if you establish that there was something like a neo-Talmudic era that continued after the early 400s, where would you, as a historian, declare that it's really over? At what point would that era be?
I would say that the Talmud is over in about the year 450.
Right.
The 500. And then after that, there's a period of about 100 years until the Gaonim are the ones that take over, and they already interpret the Talmud, and they don't add to it.
So to say that we today are in somewhat of a neo-Talmudic era, that would be wrong.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, because we're not adding to the Talmud. We're trying to understand it.
Right.
We're trying to make it as relevant as possible to ourselves, but we're not changing the Talmud anymore, and we're not adding to it. But, for instance, the great contribution of Rashi is that he made the Talmud accessible. And, you know, so in our time, we're not Rashi, but to a great extent, we have made the Talmud more accessible than it had ever been before, simply because of the fact, both in Hebrew and in English, new commentaries, you know, to help you get through the Talmud now exist. And translations and illustrations and all sorts of great progress has happened to make the Talmudic study much, much easier.
Rabbi Beryl Wine is with us, our final minutes, as we discuss the Oral Law of Sinai, an illustrated history of the Mishnah, and Vision and Valor, an illustrated history of the Talmud. In the Mishnah, Oral Law of Sinai, Rabbi Wine, you include the Shisha Sidrei Mishnah for people to see that in order.
Right, that was Rebbe's organization.
Right, and you include a Tanayim timeline, a Tanayim, of course, being those who are Mishnaic scholars. And then in the, post the epilogue in the Vision and Valor, you include an Amoraim timeline as well. Those are valuable resources. People who want to know an accurate account of that historic era will be able to use both those timelines in order to do so.
I would hope so. I think that as I mentioned before, I think it's just valuable. It gives you an insight to understand the Talmud and understand who's talking and what eras they are in.
And speaking of eras, you know, so often, and I don't know if you've ever gone through this, I would guess as a historian people have approached you with this question, You know, if he would have stayed in Europe, he would have been either this great or never would have lived up to what he became in the United States. Of course, I'm using that phrase generically. Are there certain people who, when you analyze their biographies, either in the Tanaim or the Amoraim, where you say to yourself that the times, in fact, made the man? If he would have been in a different era, he never would have been able to have had the impact that he had in his own era?
Well, I don't have to say it. I mean, that the Talmud itself says it, and the famous statements from later greater people. It says, Dor-dor v'chachomov, dor-dor v'dorshov, dor-dor. Every generation has its people. But the people in one generation are for that generation. We don't know what they would be in another generation. It would be hard to tell. You know, the Kotzker has a very sharp statement in which he says one man's righteous person in one generation would perhaps be a wicked person in another generation. And that's Rashi's comment, quoting the Medrash on Noach and his generation. In his generation, he's Noach. If he'd be in the generation of Abram, he's not Noach. Why is he not Noah? The answer is because it's a different generation, right? It's a different time. We are all products of our times. We're not people who live in a bubble.
The times make the man. Finally, Rabbi Wein, we alluded to this earlier. You're writing extensively about the current situation in 2013 in the Holy Land and beyond in general. In the Jewish community worldwide, I tried to interrupt you earlier when we touched on this topic to ask you if you'd consider yourself frustrated by the situation. Would that be not just an accurate term, but is that the right way of portraying it, or is there a different way?
I think that anyone that cares for the Jewish people, and I think anyone that cares for the future of Torah and for Orthodoxy, has to feel that. Somehow all the disputes and all of the negativity and all of the bad things that occur and all of that has to have a bad influence upon us. All of that has to make us sadder. Now, whether or not our generation is unique in that, that's a different question. Because I look through Jewish history and I see that these things abounded. Every generation had it. The difference is, in our generation, everybody knows about it. Right. And in another generation, what happened in one shtetl, what happened in Vilna, nobody in Budapest knew about it. So that made it easier, so to speak. But in our time, when everything is instantly known everywhere in the world, I think it makes the situation much more difficult. And the other, the real frustration is that we have enormous opportunities. We're the only ones that have something to market. Look in the Jewish world today. Everything else is bankrupted.
Right.
And nobody's a socialist anymore. Nobody's a communist. No, everybody is looking for something. And we have the something. So let's, if we marketed, if General Motors marketed its automobiles the way we market Torah, they never get out of bankruptcy. So we have to, we have to care for the Jewish people. We have to somehow do something for them and for others. And we have the ability to do so. We have the talents to do so. We have the people to do so. We have so many wonderful B'nai Torah that have such great abilities. So when they don't do it, so then I imagine that frustration is a good word. But I'm not a frustrated person. I'm an optimist. I've always believed in the Jewish people. I've always believed that Torah would win out. Listen, I grew up at a time when I can speak to you, because your ancestor was in Chicago with me.
Right.
That, there were 42 Orthodox synagogues in the Lawndale area, and when the neighborhood collapsed, Chicago remained, all of Chicago only had 6 Orthodox synagogues left. And people said, it can't be, there's never going to be anything in Chicago. And they're wrong, and the Torah sells itself. We just have to let it. We just have to let it.
And as beloved as some of the cities of the diaspora are to us, I can't conclude this conversation and speak to you in a public forum without asking and likely knowing how you'll respond. Do you still believe that the future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel?
Well, absolutely. The future. futures in the state of Israel. The majority of Jewish people are still going to be living in the state of Israel. I mean, and Eretz Yisrael, in every respect, influences the diaspora. Listen, you know, what happens here is really going to determine what's going to happen everywhere. So
I
have no doubts about that.
I always consider it a privilege to speak with you. Thank you so much for all the time.
A pleasure, Nachum, and be matzliach and everything.
Amen. Thank you so much. Rabbi Beryl Wein, always a delight to speak with him on any topic. Today, an amazing opportunity to speak to him about two brand new works, The Oral Law of Sinai, an illustrated history of the Mishnah, and Vision and Valor, an illustrated history of the Talmud, both brand new and both remarkable. All Koran and Magid books are available at Jewish bookstores everywhere, including J. Levine at West 30th Street between Broadway and Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. I remind you about the commuter's special where you could bring the Beit HaMikdash to life by studying Maseches Yoma in color. Order a subscription to the print edition of the Koran Talmud Bavli. Get a free digital edition. The digital edition is compatible on all mobile devices, including iPod, tablet, iPad, and more. Package has a $60 value for each volume. It's perfect for your commute to work. You can go to korenpub.com. KorenPub.com. Use the promo code JM and the AM at checkout, and you can enjoy those amazing works. And of course, for the commuter special, you can enjoy the Koren Talmud Bavli. I want to thank the folks at Koren for this segment of Buy the Book, as they continue to provide amazing scholars and incredible authors for me to speak with on a weekly basis. Don't forget that this program will be encored, but is first run in its in its brand new form every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on our stream at jmandam.org, nachumsiegel.com, what we refer to as the Nachum Siegel Network. And we continue to encourage everybody to stay tuned in, enjoy our Tuesday live lunch and all the great programming every single day on our stream as we continue to provide amazing programming. And if you're listening to this as a first run on the Tuesday after Hanukkah, I remind you that so much of our programming this week is coming from the Holy Land, including JM the AM, Monday through Thursday morning, from either the Holy City of Jerusalem or the Holy City of Hebron. And we invite you to stay tuned into our stream and, of course, to our amazing radio broadcasts when they are on the road and bridging the gap between the Holy Land and our audience in the diaspora. It is one of the things we take very seriously, and we're so glad we're able to do. Reminder that we have social media platforms that are worth following, including our Facebook update page, Jewish Radio World with Nachum Siegel, Jewish Radio World with Nachum Siegel, including our Twitter handle, Nachum Siegel Net, Nachum Siegel Net. And of course, on Instagram, just search the name Nachum Siegel, follow us, and you'll see some of the photos that we have from the Holy Land and from so many other places that we've been posting from over the last few weeks. So check that out on Instagram and join all of our social media platforms. You've been listening to Buy the Book, the Nachum Siegel Network, jmnam.org, nachumsiegel.com. A big thank you to Koren Publishers. Check out korenpub.com. And a big thank you to Rabbi Beryl Wein for joining us on this edition of Buy the Book at the Nachum Siegel Network. ¶¶